From the KGOU studios, I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Writer and translator Achi Obejas was born in Cuba and came to the U.S. with her parents as a child. The island is a central part of her work, and she writes about rupture.
Our leaving created a hollow, a space of absence, so that our absence had its own weird, ironic presence. And every Cuban family has that.
Suzette Grelot will talk with Achi Obejas about her writings, Cuba, and Twitter on today's show. But first, Joshua Landis will join us for an update on what has been happening in Syria these past few weeks.
America has the golden part of Syria, and it's not going to give it back to Assad. It's going to try to use that to get rid of Assad.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz. Well, a lot's been going on in Syria this past week, so it seemed appropriate that we get an update from our Syrian expert, Joshua Landis. Joshua's joining us from Italy today. Welcome back to the show, Joshua.
Well, Rebecca, it's great to be back with you.
Well, as I said, lots going on, and unfortunately, we only have a short amount of time, but let's cover as much as we can. Obviously, Tillerson is going to the Middle East this week. He's got a very interesting set of meetings, one in particular in Turkey, where rhetoric has kind of intensified this past week, with Erdogan even saying that he might have to use an Ottoman slap against the United States. So tell us what's going on there in regards to Syria.
Well, both America and Turkey have been defining their policies in Syria over the last few weeks. And Tillerson made a very important speech in which he said that America was going to stay in Syria for the long haul. And it's not only going to stay there in order to destroy ISIS, but it's going to stay there in order to gain leverage for an end game to get rid of Assad. So it's recommitted itself to getting rid of the Syrian regime and having free elections overseen by the UN. At least that's what Tillerson claimed. And he's also said that he's going to train 30,000 new border guards, Kurdish and other, some Arabs, but mostly Kurdish border guards. This has really annoyed Turkey because America's partners are primarily the Kurds in northern Syria. If America stays there, there is an independent state that's being developed. It's not under the authority of Assad. In fact, just a few days ago, the United States bombed a Syrian military column that was going to an oil well, and America wants to keep that oil for the Kurds. So the United States now owns 30% of Syria, and that 30% has much of its best agricultural land, 50% of its oil and gas, and controls the Euphrates River and the big dam. So America has the golden part of Syria, and it's not going to give it back to Assad. It's going to try to use that to get rid of Assad.
Well, another actor in this situation is Russia, and there have been some reports here the last couple weeks of Russian mercenaries actually being killed in skirmishes between the Syrian government and the Syrian, the SDF, the Syrian Democratic Forces, some of these so-called rebels that the U.S. is backing. What's going on there?
Well, this was this grab for oil. The United States traveled very quickly with its proxies, the SDF, in northern Syria to grab as much of the oil wells as they possibly could in order to deny them to Assad. Assad is furious at this. The Russians and Iranians are also furious. They want that oil. They sent a column to go get some of that oil. And those oil wells, America bombed them to a fare-thee-well with all kinds of heavy armaments and planes and so forth, killing over 100. Some of them turned out to be Russian mercenaries. So this has been a very important sort of punctuation in this fight.
Well, a number of shifting alliances within Syria and certainly in the region and beyond. So we will continue to watch that and check back in with you as things develop. Thank you so much for joining us all the way from Italy.
Well, it's a pleasure talking with you again, Rebecca. I can't wait to get home.
Thank you. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU. Next, Suzette will talk with writer Achi Obejas about Cuba, her work, and identity. I'm Rebecca Cruz, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Rebecca Cruz, the Assistant Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Achi Obejas was born in Cuba and came to the United States with her parents when she was 6 years old. Even though she was very young when she left Cuba, the island has played a central role in much of her work as a writer. Her novels include the books Memory Mambo, Days of Awe, and Ruins. She's also worked as a translator, including translating to Spanish work by Juno Diaz. In addition, she's been a journalist, earning a Pulitzer Prize for her work at the Chicago Tribune. Regular host Suzette Grelot spoke with Achi Obejas when she was in Norman for the Neustadt Festival on International Literature and Culture.
Achi Obejas, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, of course, for one of my favorite events, the Neustadt discussion. But let's talk about your work, and in particular, let's start with kind of your background. I mean, you are a writer of poetry and fiction. You're a translator of literature. You've worked as a journalist. You were obviously a widely read scholar and writer. So tell us about your kind of the influences, you know, the things that kind of took you down this path.
Well, poetry I've been writing since I was a little kid. I was born in Cuba, and we came here, you know, post-revolution, and my family assumed, like a lot of people who came here, especially in the early years of the revolution, that we would be going back. No one thought that there was going to be a permanent change. The history of Cuba is that, you know, there was a coup d'etat every so often, and the United States intervened every so often. So the presumption was that this would happen again. And so my father was very concerned that we'd be able to go back to Cuba and function as Cubans. And so it was very important to him that we speak Spanish. Like, English was completely prohibited in our home. And if he caught us speaking English, it was a big deal, and he'd yell. And, you know, my brother and I were both constantly irritated by this. And, you know, we fought him a lot. Now, of course, I'm very grateful because I'm fluent in Spanish thanks to that insistence on my dad's part. But one of the things that was part of his cultural preservation thing was that, of course, he wanted me to learn how to read and write in Spanish, and, you know, and to preserve that and keep that. And the national hero of Cuba is also the national poet of Cuba, José Martí. And so very early on, I must have been like 6 or 7, you know, we were reading poetry and talking about poetry because we were talking about José Martí. And José Martí, you know, wrote for kids. He actually has a couple of books that are, you know, he wrote for his son when his son was a little kid. So these were, you know, classics that are read to every Cuban child. And so I was very much introduced to poetry as something beautiful and, you know, very soulful. Very early on, and I was interested, and of course, you know, like everybody, I started writing poetry. But, you know, I had some very early successes. I won a statewide contest in Indiana when I was like 11 or something like that. So poetry was always this very personal thing that I did and that I, you know, kept with me. I didn't really, you know, the next thing that I became interested in was journalism, because in high school I got involved with the high school newspaper. We had a very active high school newspaper. We were a very rebellious high school newspaper. We did a lot of stuff that the administration didn't want us to do, which was exciting. And we got into a lot of trouble, you know, by virtue of that, which was, of course, made it all the more attractive. And I loved the sort of activist bent of journalism. That is, that journalism can enact change and can cause people to think about things differently. When I got to college, by accident, really, I couldn't get into a poetry workshop because they were all full. And I ended up signing up for a fiction workshop with a little Jewish Polish professor who wore a bow tie and who referred to every single person in his class by their last name. So, of course, I was Miss Obejas. Melvin Platinsky and Dr. Platinsky was running this fiction workshop. And, you know, we never should have gotten along, but I adored him. He really taught me about story and about how to move into fiction. I remember a lot of my first drafts, I was still thinking in journalist terms, and I would defend the actions in the story by saying, but that's how it really happened. And he would say, it doesn't matter. You're the god of the story. You can do whatever you want. You can make it do happen. You know, anything can happen. So I started writing fiction and really enjoying writing fiction. Translation is a really kind of a perverse thing that happened. It took me a long time to realize that I'd been translating for a really long time because I was translating for my parents. You know, when we had to place a call to Cuba, I was the person who had to talk to the international operator. Oftentimes, official papers came in, and I would be the person who would have to explain to my parents. My parents are professionals, and they were English speakers, but obviously, when you're, you know, a kid, you absorb language like a sponge. It's a very different thing, and you get all the nuances that you don't get when you learn language as an adult. You learn language intuitively as a child. And so I was doing a lot of interpreting for them. I didn't realize that's what I was doing. I was just sort of bridging for my parents. So I always had this facility, and I used it, but I didn't really understand it as such. When I started doing creative writing as a practice, I began to translate poems just for the sake of doing the close reading that's required of translating. And when I worked as a journalist at Tribune, I oftentimes would translate for the Spanish language section and things like that. But I didn't see myself as a translator. It wasn't until I edited an anthology called Havana Noir, where I sort of by accident ended up translating 13 of the 18 stories, that I had to sort of grapple with this notion of being a translator in the world. My editor and I hadn't realized that there would be a translation component when we came up with a contract for the project. And in fact, we had to sort of back up and say, well, actually, you know, you have to pay me now for this extra thing I did. And there was no qualm. I mean, they were happy to pay me. These guys are great. But it hadn't even entered our minds when we started talking about this. And then I sort of entered the world as a translator, which was a really curious thing. And then the next thing that happened was sort of momentous, which was that I was hired to translate Junot Diaz. And then that became a very big deal. And then I had to sort of take the label and, you know, adopt it and claim it and embrace it and say, yeah, I guess I do this.
So I'm going to follow up on this notion of translation, of course, in a second, and particularly what you said, grappling with the title and taking the label. But let's talk about Cuba first, your Cuban heritage. You've also written a title, This Is What Happened in Our Other Life, a chapbook about by that title. Is that kind of referring to Cuba? I mean, how much do you remember about Cuba? You said you left there, or at least I read on your website maybe that you left at a young age. I think it was around six or so.
I left at a very young age. I left when I was 6 and a half. We came by boat, middle of the night, the whole thing, you know, got lost at sea, were rescued by an American oil freighter. But I went back as an adult in 1995, and then I made many visits after that. And in 1999, I went back to Cuba to live. So my memories of early Cuba are very much tainted by my adult experience and, you know, functioning as a citizen in Cuba and being a part of Cuba. I was born in Cuba. I don't just have Cuban heritage. I was born in Cuba. I'm a Cuban citizen. I have a Cuban passport. I'm also an American citizen. I also have an American passport. But
I think a lot of people don't realize that you can be
both,
a Cuban
right,
and an American citizen,
right,
hold passports.
So, and Cuba isn't recognized by American citizenship, which is really interesting. I mean, for me to get in and out of the country, I have to use the Cuban passport. When we talk about my memories of Cuba, I mean, my memories of Cuba are actually fairly recent, and they're adult memories, much fresher and much more vivid than the memories from being a little kid. As one would expect, we tend to have fresher, more detailed memories of more recent events.
But these experiences, both when you were a child and in your many times that you've been back and have lived there since, influenced the kind of work that you've done?
Absolutely.
The writing,
I mean, Cuba is very much my topic. It's interesting that you mention This Is What Happened in Our Life, because that's probably the least Cuban of all of my books. It's a poetry chapbook. It's really about heartbreak and love and relationships that don't necessarily work out the way we want. But a lot of the other work that I've done has been very much about Cuba. Ruins is about Cuba post the Soviet collapse, what's called euphemistically the special period, and about the sudden poverty of everyone on the island and how everyone wanted to leave. And it's a story that's very sympathetic to its protagonist, who is a very committed militant of the revolution, but whose world has completely shattered by virtue of this, you know, economic turn. Days of Awe is a novel that uses as background the history of Jews in Cuba, which is very complex and very mysterious and awkwardly documented, because Jews weren't technically allowed in the Spanish colonies, and Cuba was a colony until 1898, so very, very late in the game, the last of the colonies, of the Spanish colonies to be free. So it's very much my subject, in part because there's so much rupture in my life around Cuba. And so I write about rupture. I write about belonging and not belonging. I write about, you know, private and public emotions. I write about power and how power affects people. You know, if it hadn't been for forces outside of our family, my family would have remained in Cuba. If, you know, forces that we could not control, you know, power, history, at play to create a situation which was untenable for my parents. And so that disrupted our lives. But it didn't just disrupt our lives. It disrupted, you know, the lives of my grandparents, the lives of my cousins, the lives of my aunts and uncles. You know, our leaving created a hollow, a space of absence, so that our absence had its own weird, ironic presence. And every Cuban family has that. Every single Cuban family has that. And that's, this situation isn't unique to Cuba. Every country that's had this kind of disruption, you know, has had war, revolution, you know, civil strife like this, you know, economic collapses. This is happening all over the world. It's happening right now in Venezuela. It happens in Haiti every other day. It happens in the Dominican Republic. It's happening in the Middle East. God knows, Syria is completely convulsed. And, you know, this notion of this constant absence and longing and belonging and trying to create family through these fractures and through these ruptures, these are the things that interest me.
And it's perhaps one thing that binds a lot of people together, too, this notion Absolutely. Of rupture and disrupture. Well, let's talk quickly here as we conclude about being a translator, because the way in which you characterize, I was going to ask you about being a translator, but you characterized it as kind of grappling with it and taking the label. Why?
Because I'm
grapple?
A writer. I'm a writer.
So and it's hard for writers to say, I'm going to be a translator?
For me, it was there was a risk of then being viewed as a translator as opposed to a writer. You know, I'm a writer who has had a great deal of critical success, but who is, you know, a mid-list writer who, you know, I'm not Junot Diaz. I don't sell like that. And so to turn to translation, which is an activity I love. I absolutely love translation. I love you know, handling the language. I love the conundrums and the challenges of translation. But the idea of suddenly being perceived by the world as a translator as opposed to a creator of work, it was a little bit anxiety provoking.
I guess in my mind, the translator, I mean, you obviously get to take some, you have to make some choices.
It's all decisions.
Right?
Yeah,
so you're making
absolutely.
Choices about how to present somebody's
absolutely.
Words in another language. So, and that's very important, right? The language itself. So it's almost kind of like you're maybe not writing it from scratch, but that you're, you know,
it's
writing
a creative...
in a way, but it's in a different way.
Yeah,
you know?
No, it's absolutely a creative act. There's no question about it. I mean, it's an art, it's a creative act, it's a practice. It absolutely feeds my work, my original work, my creative writing, and I'm happy to do it. But it is a different practice, you know, and it's one that I would never reject it. I don't want my embrace of it to reject my first love, you know, which is writing my own stories, my own novels, my own work. You know, it's a little bit like I feel about poets and poetry. You know, I write poetry. I love poetry. I read poetry every single day. I make my students, my prose students, read poetry. I think poetry is the lifeblood of literature. I think everything is derived from poetry. But I am loath to teach poetry. I've been approached about teaching poetry, and I always back away from it and say, no, I'd rather not, because I know that it would require, you know, a different energy from me than what I use for prose. And also because I like being intuitive about poetry. I don't want to have to get down in the nitty-gritty and take it apart and be conscious and aware of it the way I am of prose. You know, I like this sort of innocence with which I still can, you know, love poetry. I can respond to something without necessarily knowing why it's working and feel fine about it. And I think for me, that's part of the awe and wonder. I know that there's awe and wonder in understanding all the mechanics of it. I mean, I feel that way about a lot of prose. What I love is exactly what they're doing, and I love that knowing how they're doing it. But I feel this sense of magic about poetry that I really want to protect. So I feel this sense of ownership about my own work that I never want anyone to think that I am less loyal to it than I am.
So 10 seconds, you're not only a writer, you're a tweeter. Like 25,000 tweets. Why? Does this help you get your words out there? Is this something that is, or is it kind of hearkening back to that kind of exciting activist in you? What is?
It's a little bit of the journalism. Yeah. You know, what I love about Twitter is being able to, you know, curate the news and hooking into all that stuff. But I mean, it's fun. It's a fun thing to do. Yeah. I don't like the fact that they've upped it to 280.
Actually, I don't either.
Yeah, I'm really like, happy with the 140.
Which
makes
is
it quick.
Strange as a writer, right? You'd want
right.
more space, but no.
Exactly. No. That's like, I got used to 140. I'm happy with 140.
And to be honest, it's kind of a creative thing that you have to be very creative in 140 characters.
Succinct.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I like
focus.
It. All right. Well, Aji, thank you so much for being
thank
here
you.
Today. Really interesting story about your work and your life. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You've been listening to Suzette Grelot's conversation with Aji Obejas. She's a writer, journalist, and translator whose works include Memory Mambo, Days of Awe, and Ruins. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClelland edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Suzette Grelot and Joshua Landis, I'm Rebecca Cruz.